On episode 637 of the 40 Plus Fitness podcast, we meet Dr. Sharon Malone and discuss her book, Grown Woman Talk, Your Guide to Getting and Staying Healthy. You can find the full show notes for this episode at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/637. Have you decided you're ready to make a change? To reclaim your health and fitness, the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast is here for you. Each week, we dive deep into health and fitness topics that affect those of us over 40. I'm Coach Allen. I'm an NASM certified personal trainer with specializations in corrective exercise, behavior change, performance enhancement, and fitness nutrition. A precision nutrition level 1 coach, a FAI certified functional ageing specialist, and an OTA level 2 online trainer. Each week, I'm joined by our co-host, Coach Rachel. She is an NASM certified personal trainer and a RRCA level 1 run coach. Let us be your coaches as you find your way on your health and fitness journey. All right, let's go. Hey, Raz, how you doing?
Good, Alan. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. Things are back to normal-ish. Tammy's good. Back. She's healing from her surgery. So she's around, and that's helping a lot because she's taking on the chores at Lula's. I'm stepping in when she needs me. But this is allowing me to kind of step out back into what I do, which is online coaching.
Nice.
And then last week I had three podcast interview. So as soon as we rolled out, she got back. It was like, boom, boom, boom. Had to have all those interviews to catch up. But but that's good. I'm getting caught up, guys.
good.
And I said this a couple times, but I am getting on other podcasts. And rather than mention each of those individually here, I just encourage you to go to 40plusfitness.com. That's 40plusfitness.com/media. And that'll take you to my media appearances page, and you can kind of scroll through there and see various podcasts that I've been on. Some of them are really, really good. I'm really proud of the conversations we had there. So I'd strongly encourage you, if you got some extra time and you want to listen to a little bit more of me, why? I don't know. But if you do, you'll learn a few things. I'd go check that out. So how are things up there?
Good. Like Tammy, I'm also recovering from my eye surgery. I don't want to gross out our listeners, but there's a lot done in my eye, not just like a laser surgery, but a little bit of stitches and a little bit of work so that I kind of got a realignment of my eyes, kind of like you realign the tires of your car. My eyes got put back together. So hopefully I'll be able to see a little better, not see double so much, and not have the depth perception issues that I was having before. So just kind of taking it easy, letting my eye heal, and in another week or two, I'll be back at it.
Well, yes, follow the advice of your doctor.
Yes.
You know, be the grown woman that you need to be.
As hard as it is, it's important.
Mm-hmm. So are you ready to talk a little bit more about grown woman talk?
Sounds good.
Our guest today is a board-certified OBGYN and a certified menopause practitioner who has practiced medicine in the nation's capital for more than 30 years. She is the chief medical officer of Alloy Women's Health and a passionate advocate for improved research and education around women's health in midlife. With no further ado, here's Dr. Sharon Malone. Dr. Sharon, welcome to 40 Plus Fitness.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I have to say, I love, 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 love the name of your book, Grown Woman Talk, Your Guide to Getting and Staying Healthy. We need to have more grown people talk, don't we?
We certainly do. And if anything, we need more intergenerational grown women talking to each other, because I think each generation enters this space not having any idea what to do.
Yeah, I think, you know, we get into puberty, and for fortunate, we have our parents with us, and they can kind of explain what this is all about, because they've gone through it. But we kind of almost forget that. It's like, yeah, my you know, if
my wife's like, her mother went through menopause at a certain age and is dealing with certain health issues. And she's, but my wife doesn't tend to have the question until she has the problem. Exactly. And that's, and sometimes you've lost that generation before you have the problem and you don't have that opportunity to have that conversation.
Exactly. And you know what, or even if you do, sometimes you're, that generation has forgotten. It's been so long. It's like, oh, I don't remember. And, you know, and we as women generally minimize, we're minimizers. So however bad it was in the moment, you know, if I ask you about it 20 years from now, you go, oh, it wasn't that bad, which we know that was not the case. So I think that this conversation about how to, what to expect when we get to midlife and beyond is really an iterative conversation. It's not a one and done. You know, you start talking about it, you know, you talk about it in your 30s, because the one thing I assure everyone is that if you are a person and you are born with ovaries, you will go through menopause if you are lucky enough to live that long. So it's not something that we could or should ignore, but we have been.
Yeah. There's two, a couple of different unfortunate things. I mean, but I think one of the big ones, and I've read this several times, is that particularly women, when they go to a male doctor, he's never experienced what you're experiencing. And even if it's a woman doctor and she has experienced menopause or something, yours is different. Now, your mother's may give you a better indication of what yours could be like, but not necessarily. And so it really is this conversation of, okay, what can I learn from others and their experiences? Your mother and your grandmother are probably your best bet to give you a true picture. But by the time you're getting into menopause, your grandmother's probably not here and your mother may not be here. And so this is just something to go through. And I love how you gave some, I'm going to call them practical tips, but these are really strategies. These are deeper than tips, because this is some important stuff. So first I want to talk about, because I think this is a really important topic, and I've gotten into it before, but the way you put it was really just at a different level that got me thinking. Become your own best primary caregiver.
Exactly. And the reason why I want to, women, and actually everyone, to understand this is that the nature of medicine has changed, you know, and I'm old enough to have lived through a couple of versions of what medical care looks like. And it's very different now than it was 30 years ago when I started to practice. And the locus of control has really shifted gradually and now suddenly from the doctor to the patient. And I think that most people are not aware of that shift, because what we had, our expectations, I should say, of what a doctor-patient relationship was like 30, 40 years ago, that is no longer going to exist. You know, I had the good, great fortune to live in one town with one practice for almost 30 years. So I actually took care of young girls in high school, through college, through their pregnancies, and on through perimenopause. And that kind of long-term relationship that gives you some gravitas and a little bit of trust factor when you're dealing with patients, that's just not going to be the case. I mean, our interactions and our relationships with our doctors these days are more transactional. It's going to depend on where you are. You may move, your insurance may change. And so you have to face the reality that every time you go in for a visit, you may see the same doctor, but chances are there are many times that you will not. And so that means that no one knows what's going on with you better than you. So I wanted to give people the information that they need. So how do I become my own best caregiver? And those were the, you know, tips or strategies that I sort of wove through the entire book.
Yeah. So this goes much deeper than just being an advocate for your best care. This is you actually, you know, caring for yourself, finding the right doctor, doing the right things. And I can tell you, yes, with insurance and this and that and doctors in plans and out of plans, and it's a mess.
Yeah. And you know what? At the very beginning of my book, when we're talking about, you know, how to pick a doctor, what is important about your medical history that you need to be in charge of, and your family history, and even the chapters at the end about community and how to prepare for the inevitable end. These are things that are really not gender specific. I mean, you could, I hope that, you know, as you read the book, you'll get some tips on both ends of those. It's only in the middle that we talk specifically to women, but there's a lot of commonality there. And I think that people just don't understand. And it's not that they're not capable. It's not hard. It's just that, you know, it's like you're playing a game and no one told you what the rules were. And I'm trying to give you a little bit of a heads up on, well, this is how the game is played. You'll be a much better player if you know it.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be, like you said, you'd go to one doctor, that was your family doctor, and you were there as a kid. He may have even delivered you, and now he's still your doctor. And, you don't move from a pediatrician to this doctor just because you turned 12. It's the same doctor. And so we used to have that relationship, but we also used to think, well, whatever the doctor tells me, I have to do. It's like he's, have this kind of halo that I have to listen to you. And now we find, okay, well, doctors are great, but they can make mistakes too. So we just have to be aware. We do have to advocate for ourselves. When you go to your doctor's visit, you can demand that someone else be there with you. Particularly when we're starting to deal with some very significant health issues, you may need someone relatively objective to hear what the doctor's saying, because you might not be in the right state of mind to hear what you need to hear.
That is exactly right. Particularly when you're giving, when you're getting bad news for whatever reason or complicated news. We, you know, fear and, you know, anxiety sort of takes over, and we don't hear exactly what people say. But let me say this on the other end. Doctors say things and they pat themselves on the back and said, whoa, well, I did a really great job of explaining that, without ever really taking into account the cues that, you know, look at someone's face. Did you understand me? Because most people are trying to be agreeable in that interaction and they don't want to waste your time. And that is the kind of communication that's really got to improve between doctors and patients. So I always say, bring another person with you. And here's another just simple thing. If you can't bring another person with you, because again, that's taking time off, having someone else come with you, that's a big ask for a lot of people. You know, say, doctor, do you mind if I record this conversation? Now, everybody's got a phone in their pocket. It's okay to say, well, I just want to make sure that I remember everything that you said. Put your phone on the desk and record it. Now, doctors aren't going to say anything that, you know, will be proprietary, but it will be helpful for you when you go home. Oh, what were those instructions, or what did he or she say? Simple things like that that help.
Absolutely. Now, given the way things are with insurance and everything else, and particularly in the United States, we do have to find a doctor. Versus just being, this was my mama's and daddy's doctor, so now it's my doctor. Now we have to go find one. So we've got this list in the network and we're like, okay, I got to pick a doctor. How do we go about making sure that this doctor is the right doctor for us?
Right. There are some basic things you can do just to, you know, do a little research. Most doctors have websites. You can get a sense of, you know, at least where this doctor went to school, whether or not they're board certified. There are websites that I give you, that I give in the reference section, that just says, let me just do a little due diligence. This doctor have, you know, lawsuits pending? Has this doctor had, you know, various and sundry other issues that have been reported? Because we are required to report those to a central database. So that's just your basic fact finding. Now, because a doctor went to Harvard, does that make them great? No, not necessarily. Might mean they're pretty smart, but how a doctor actually interacts with you, whether or not they hear you, they see you, these are important points in terms of what your relationship is going to be. So I say, yeah, crowdsource it. You know, talk to your friends, talk to people who may or may not have seen this physician. They'll usually give you some good feedback. I always caution when people are looking at online ratings for doctors, because I say, well, you know, sometimes they're helpful, sometimes they're not. But I assure you that people who have had great experiences may take the time to fill out an online survey. Patients who've had terrible experiences for whatever reason that may not have had anything to do with you, they're going to be the ones who are most motivated to go on an online rating system. So you have to take all of that with a grain of salt and really know that there are a lot of ways in, and I'm sure you know this, in online ratings to really juke the stats. So yeah. I would say, okay, look at a few comments if you must, but this is a doctor's visit. It's not a restaurant. It's not Yelp. So, yeah. You know,
this is an Amazon,
you know, yeah, take it for what it's worth. But I think the most important interaction that you're going to have when you're really trying to choose a doctor is to call the doctor's office. And you can usually speak to an administrator or someone and just ask some very basic questions. You know, what's the average wait time for this doctor? You know, it may be that you don't mind because you're seeing the doctor once a year. But if you have something that's going to require ongoing care, I need to know that the wait is not 6 months. I need to have basic answers like, well, if I have an emergency or I need an appointment for something that's not routine, how is that handled? I mean, the basic logistics of the office, you don't need to go in and have and pay for a doctor's visit to get those questions answered, but someone in that office should be able to. So you at least get the lay of the land. And I say, you know, I always say, don't let the perfect get in the way of the good. You want to have a good, competent doctor who's convenient, who's within your insurance plan, who knows how to handle the basic things that you need to have done. And most people are not seeing doctors in extremis in the beginning. That's sort of where you start and you establish a relationship. And that's your opportunity to then, when you have an in-person visit, to trust your gut. You know, did this patient doctor interaction seem rushed? Were they harried? Were they typing when I was talking? I mean, these are all, you know, trust your gut moments. So all of that really has to go into that interaction about how to pick a doctor. And here's the other thing. Don't be afraid. If this one isn't working for you, go find another one. There's usually someone else. There are other people to choose from. So don't stick with something because, you know,
yeah. Maybe well, unless you're in a really small town, you're probably not.
Right. Unless you're in a really small town. That's exactly right.
And then I'm going out of network. Sorry. Not sorry. The next topic I want to get into, and the idea of it was just, it just was like eye-opening. It's called a medical family tree. So I think we all know what a family tree is. And I think for most of us, our medical history with our family is an oral tradition. You know, it's like I remember something with my mom and her ovarian. I think it was ovarian cancer back when she was, you know, when I was little. You know, I know that my grandfather died of lung cancer or esophageal cancer because he smoked. My grandmother had a stroke at the age of around probably 40. So I have this oral history that I generally know, or at least have some idea, but I don't really have a family medical tree or medical family tree.
Right. And it's important because at the very least, you need to have a sense of, and let me say this. I come from a family, you know, my parents were very, very much older and they didn't even have the same language that we had for things. So you remember, cancer in my mother and father's time was a monolithic disease. I mean, you didn't know it was cancer of what, because by the time so many people older in your grandparents' generation, by the time they were diagnosed, it was metastatic. And by then it's an academic exercise. Well, was it throat cancer or colon cancer? Who knew? So sometimes, you know, you're going to get to a point where you realize that that's as far as I can go. So I say, if you can at least get the information from your parents, from their siblings, and your immediate family, and if you can go back farther than that, great. And even if you don't know the specifics, you do have an idea who died young. Was it sudden? Was it after a long protracted illness? And it allows you to make certain inferences about what may have been the case. But common things like high blood pressure, diabetes, you know, who was on dialysis, you know, who was, you know, in a nursing home for 20 years, important data points. Because the one thing that I want people to know is that just because you have a family history of something does not mean that that is your destiny. And I say this a lot, genetics is not destiny. Your family history gives you sort of an idea of what you may be susceptible to, not necessarily what you are going to have. So don't accept because everybody in your family or generations have had diabetes or strokes that that's your reality. No, that means that that gives you an opportunity to alter behaviors, to change lifestyle in a way that will help you avoid those things. So that's why it's important to know it, you know, not just for, oh my God, this is gloom and doom. No, this is a huge opportunity for you to do better.
Yeah. Now, another thing that comes up, and this is, this has to be relatively new because, you know, medications are being invented every year. There's an advertisement for some pill on today, right now, if you turn on your television, there's something out there you should be taking that you're not taking.
Exactly. Don't watch the news. My goodness. Like, wow.
But I guess polypharmacy, polypharmacy is this thing where people are getting on to, I guess it's called five or more medications. And, you know, you start to thinking, well, yeah, some things are related. Obviously, if you have high blood pressure, your cholesterol is probably out of whack. Your sugar's probably out of whack. And so they start you on these things. And I know at one point in my life, I was on a pill and it wasn't working well enough. So the doctor says, well, I'm going to add another pill rather than up the dose with that one. I'm going to give you another pill. You take both. And so I was like, okay, I'm going down this line. If I don't fix my health, then that's where I would probably be right now, is on five or more medications. And simple is safe in my mind, because if I know it's one pill I take twice a day, I can kind of do that math and figure that out. But if I've got five different pills with five different things, I'm having five different conversations with maybe five different doctors, this can get complicated pretty quickly. I can end up taking something that I shouldn't be taking. I can end up taking things that don't agree with other things. And then we add in supplements, and it just really complicates this whole thing. So how do we manage this whole medicated lifestyle that we often find ourselves drifting into?
Exactly. Well, one of the things that I talk a lot about is prevention, you know, because most of us, as we age, will get in, just as you said, you're taking things, you know, for high blood pressure, for diabetes, for cholesterol lowering medications. And I think that in some cases they're appropriate. And in some cases, doctors will give you medications. And what I say, why in doctor speak, we say prophylactically, you know, they'll put you on a lipid lowering drug just because your cholesterol is up. Well, the question is, well, do I have any other risk factors for cardiovascular disease, or are we just treating a cholesterol number? So I think that there's a reflexive thing that doctors do, is that the answer to everything is medication, because it's easier. And I'm not doctor bashing. I'm one. I love my colleagues. Don't get me wrong. But we are often practicing in silos. We are not communicating one with the other. We are not talking about overall health strategies for how to change your diet, how to, you know, what you can do to minimize your risk of diabetes. And this is where it gets back to one of the things I talked about in the book, is how to establish your medical team. Because quite frequently, and there's a little bit of blame on both parts, your doctors may or may not know what you're already on. And if you don't come in with a complete list of your medications to each and every doctor that you see, they may be either over-prescribing or duplicating prescriptions. And, you know, so again, a little bit, this is getting back to being your own best caregiver. You're in charge of keeping track of what medications you're on. And you're right. Simpler is better. You know what else is better? Cheaper is better. I give a little bit of advice, and I say this. I said, if whatever medication your doctor is giving you, they're advertising it six times an evening on TV, you're probably paying too much for that medication. So it is quite okay to ask your doctor when they want to prescribe medication. One, make sure you know what you are taking it for. And I kid you not, 9 times out of 10, and particularly when you're dealing, it's not just the older patients, they will say, I said, well, what is this for? I don't know. My doctor said, take it. And they're just taking it. So have them explain to you why you're taking it. Two, whatever it is that I'm taking, is this a branded drug? Is there a less expensive option that's covered under my insurance that I can use? Because again, you know, expensive and new does not always equate to better. And so these are, again, this is you taking charge, and as opposed to just saying, well, my doctor said, take this. And when you get to be older, if you look at, you know, your parents' pill cases, and my God, it's not only that it's a lot of them, it's a lot of them that are to be given at different times of the day. Take this one in the morning with food, take this one at bedtime, you know, and it is so easy to mess that up. Yeah. You know, I feel the same way. I take a couple of medications, and if I don't put them in a pill box that says Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I can't even remember whether I took it or not. I'm like, did I? I don't know. So imagine that when you multiply it, and then you have people that are, you know, older, you're just asking too much, and you're asking for mistakes to happen.
Yeah. And another thing I would just like to add is, when you're going to take a new medication, just be aware of what some of the side effects might be. My doctor had prescribed niacin. And so I'd taken that niacin in the morning, and I was walking through, I think it was Costco, and I just flushed, and I wasn't sure, you know, is this a heart attack? What is this that's going on? So I did, I called my doctor after I got home. I was like, I don't know what happened. I was walking through Costco, and I just got really hot and tingly, and I don't know what's going on. Should I go to the emergency room? He's like, no. He said, you took your niacin this morning, didn't you? And I'm like, yeah. And he said, that's what that is.
Yeah.
You know, he said, yeah. So I'm like, well, I can't take it if that's going to happen. He says, well, just try to take it before you go to bed instead of taking in the morning. Mm-hmm. But that, with instructions on it, said take every morning with food. And that's what I had done. He's like, no, just take it in the evening before you go to bed, and you'll be fine. And right. So I would have a couple of hot flashes like women do, I guess. I don't know. I haven't had one, so I can't compare. But I would have these flashes at night, early in the night, so not too bad. But I was glad to be able to lower my blood pressure another way, and I didn't have to take the niacin anymore. But I didn't know that side effect. So it scared me when I had it. So just understanding that these aren't necessarily dangerous side effects, but just knowing I could be really, really thirsty after taking this one, or I could, you know, this could make me feel a little nauseous at times and things like that. Just knowing that will give you a little bit of peace of mind that you're not doing something you shouldn't be doing.
Exactly.
Now, in the book, you talked about why we tend to gain weight over 40. And then you were nice enough to tell us what to do about it. Could you go over that?
Yes. Well, you know, there's this big debate, particularly for women, because we start to put on weight usually between about 40 and 50. That's when you see the biggest chunk of weight gain. And then you start to gain weight at a slower rate, but you still do gain weight between about 50 and 60 if you don't understand that it's coming and what to do about it. So the debate about whether, is it just aging that's causing the weight gain, or is it menopause that's causing the weight gain? And I think there's some combination of the two, and certainly for women who are in that menopausal transition. If you know it, you know, this is not high order science here. Your metabolism starts to slow a bit. Your body composition changes as you get older. You start to lose muscle, so you have less muscle, more fat. Even when you're weight neutral, that's just part of aging, and particularly part of menopause. And what we all know is that fat is less metabolically active than muscle. So even same weight, someone who has a higher percentage body fat is going to have a much more difficult time losing weight with the same amount of calories in and calories out as someone who has a fair amount of lean muscle mass. So that's why, you know, there are a million ways, a million reasons why you should exercise, but exercise, as far as weight is concerned, is really a way to preserve and maintain your current weight, not a way to lose weight. And I say that so many times. You're doing so many good things for yourself. So exercise, because it's good for your heart, it's good for your brain, it's good for your mood, and it helps you, keeps you strong as you age. But as a weight loss strategy, if that's all you got, you're going to be sorely disappointed. But I do, if I tell you this ahead of time, and this is the biggest strategy, particularly for women. If I say to you, you know what, on average, you know, women are going to gain anywhere from a pound to 2 pounds a year. And sometimes you don't gain it at that same clip, but you kind of end up at the same place at the end where, you know, wow, I gained 20 pounds and I didn't do anything different. Then I say to them, I said, well, then therein lies the problem. You didn't do anything different. You're going to have to alter your, and I say, not going to focus on food because I don't really, you know, I don't have a preference about one diet or the other. Eat a healthy diet, lots of fresh fruits, vegetables, and fiber. That's it. But you really have got to start changing, again, those behaviors around it. And for women who are transitioning, the one thing that we do know about changes in estrogen levels, as you know, during the menopausal transition and beyond, is that whether you gain weight or lose weight or stay the same, the biggest determinant for women in this transition is the change in their body composition. They lose muscle, gain fat, and not only do you gain fat, but you gain fat exactly where you don't want it, which is in your midsection. And that is a hormonal effect of lack of estrogen, where women will tend to put weight where it is the least healthy place to put it, when we call, you know, apple shape versus a pear shape, because when you put weight on around your middle, on the outside, you may think it's unattractive, but it's really dangerous because it is accumulating on the inside too, around your vital organs, your heart in particular. And that's where, you know, if we say we really want it to affect a change in your behavior, you're going to exercise to keep that weight at least in check. So, you know, if I knew the answer to what to do about weight, I would be talking to you from my boat right now. Mediterranean. I don't have that.
Yeah, this book would be something else. But no, yeah, but you're right. You know, the thing is, you know, I've worked with a lot of women, and you're absolutely right. As their hormones shift, the look shifts, where they're carrying the fat shifts. But it's not impossible to not gain that weight, but it's also possible to lose that weight. You do have to change your lifestyle.
Right.
If you're not sleeping well, focus on getting that squared away. If you're overstressed, your cortisol levels are too high, focus on getting that down. And then, yes, eat a good, nutritious meal and make sure that you're giving your body the nutrition it needs and no more. Right. You know, avoid sugar, avoid alcohol, avoid those things that are not going to serve you for this.
Right.
And move. But the movement can be about who you want to be, not necessarily how you want to look. So, you know, you don't want to lose muscle and be, you know, the feeble old woman. So lift a little bit of weights, you know, do some resistance training, keep yourself strong, and eat well, but eat good quality food that's nutritious. And this is, like you say, it's not rocket science. We all know these things. We have to do it. And if you're getting to that point, you're seeing it happen. It's not going to get any better if you don't do something about it.
Exactly. And, you know, and this is a very important point where prevention really comes in, because if I tell you that at 40, okay, and all my patients knew, I used to have that question, that they go like, oh, Dr. Malone. And I'm like, no, I'm not concerned about what you look like. I'm concerned about what your health is going to be at the end of this. And particularly since I told you that we want everybody to know what their family history is, or what their family health tree is like. If you know that every woman in your family gained, you know, 30 pounds by the time they were 60, and they weren't hypertensive before, but then they're on medication or then they're diabetics. That's your cue right there. You can turn that ship around. And so I focus more on, because I think that we focus on the wrong things when we're talking about weight. And I don't really care so much about weight. There's not a particular number on the scale or a certain BMI to take into account, because the BMI is a very blunt instrument for trying to decide how you are going to age healthfully. What I want, what I focus on is saying, all right, you're going to gain a pound or two a year. And my philosophy has always been, it's much easier to not gain a pound or two a year than it is to you lose 10 or 20, 10 years from now. So if I tell you that, you have the opportunity early on to avoid that with some very minor modifications in your lifestyle. But the end goal is not a particular weight, but to make sure that you are metabolically healthy, that at the end of this journey, you're not hypertensive, you're not diabetic, you don't have all these other health problems, your triglycerides aren't high, your cholesterol isn't high, and you can tamp down the inflammatory changes that come with all of this excess weight as well, which, and that's something, you know, I mentioned, but there's a lot of information out there on just the role of inflammation and what it does in terms of your overall health. And, you know, you touched upon something earlier, and you're right. Sleep is important. You know, people who don't get enough sleep and have disruptive sleep, guess what that leads to? Hypertension, diabetes, and weight gain, because it's harder to control yourself the next day when you're tired and fatigued and not feeling well. We self-soothe in a lot of these circumstances. And as you said, your cortisol levels are high. So there are, I find, if you want people to do better, if you just make the simple connections for them and explain to them why one leads to the other and how, you know, if you go into a doctor's office and your doctor says, you need to lose 20 pounds and they walk out the door, then I think that you've been given really short shrift. Everybody says, yeah, I'd love to lose 20 pounds. Can you give me an idea of how that works or what I'm supposed to do that? And tell me before I've gained the 20 pounds, not after the fact. I think you'll be a lot more successful that way.
Well, I think this is also a part of that family tree that you were talking about. Yeah. If my father was obese, if my grandfather was obese, and you know I'm eating the same way that they ate, I can pretty much expect something to happen, you know, as I get older. So I've got to change something, or right. I see my path. It's right. Drawn for me. So, you know, those are the things that I think that, right. Again, this is really valuable to kind of look at, because
right.
The evidence is already there. No one has to tell you.
Well, you know what? You know, I have the luxury of having seen my family tree in action. You know, my parents, as I said, my parents were much older. So when I say much older, my dad was born in the 1890s. My mother was born in 1914. So they were the generation probably of your grandparents and great grandparents. And I watched them, but they were very, you know, they were farmers, you know, they grew up on a farm and they didn't have to go to the gym. Your life was exercise.
Yeah.
So, you know, they ate farm to table because that's what you had to eat. Right. Neither of my parents was overweight, never. Right. But I'm the youngest of eight kids. So I have watched my older brothers and sisters as they've gone through this journey. Like I said, didn't need to take a note on this. You just watch them. And they went from being, you know, normal size young adults. They got to middle age. They became overweight. And many of them, by the time they got to be, you know, seniors, were very overweight, if not obese. Now, again, is that genes? I don't think so. It is about the difference in lifestyle and what they have done.
I think that's the aisles in the grocery store they're choosing to shop on and how much movement they have in their lives.
That is exactly right. So, you know what? And I, you know, a little light bulb went off over my head and I was like, you know what? I think that's where I'm headed if I keep doing these same things. And again, not genes, just lifestyle behavior and eating habits. So, Absolutely. You can get control of it. And that's what I want people to know. Just know it ahead of time.
Again, be your primary caregiver.
Exactly.
Prevention. Dr. Sharon, I define wellness as being the healthiest, fittest, and happiest you can be. What are three strategies or tactics to get and stay well?
Well, here's one. I think that, you know, again, can't overemphasize the importance of, again, staying physically healthy. Understanding, and this is, I do talk about this book, there's a concept called interoception. And that is the concept of knowing what you feel like when you are free of disease, free of any sort of chronic ailment. And you know what it feels, everyone knows what it feels like because you are unaware of your body parts generally. You know, when we are not well, oh, this hurts, that hurts, you know, or I'm tired, fatigued. Interoception is what you feel like when you are free of all of those things. Okay. And I want people to get in tune with that because what happens as we age, we lose sight of that. And when your baseline of just feeling completely normal and unaware of, you know, said body parts is that you are chronically fatigued or you are in chronic pain, it dulls that sense because it's very important that you know pain is an important indicator that something is awry. And when you don't, when you take that as your baseline, oh, well, I'm older and I'm just supposed to feel bad, then you don't, you can't recognize the things and the signals your body's trying to give you. So I say, get aware of what you're, what you feel like when you feel normal and don't accept a baseline that is indicating that there is something else going on in your body because you can't listen to it that way. I think it's also important to be mentally healthy. And, you know, we don't always have control over that, but I tell you this, if you are chronically stressed, if you are in a toxic environment, be it work, be it family life, be it whatever it is that is chronically stressing you out, we can't always control, not always, the circumstances that we find ourselves in or what life brings you. Then you need to figure out a strategy for how to deal with it. And sometimes it involves a mental health professional. Sometimes we get back to things like exercise, it helps. And sometimes it just means removing yourself from those toxic situations or removing those toxic people from your life, because I cannot overemphasize enough how much the connection exists between your mental health and your physical health. So that's number two. And three, I would really say another strategy is to always, always, always maintain community, because we have seen, you know, I think with certainly exacerbated by COVID, this epidemic of loneliness and isolation. And that also weighs heavily on your health and just your general sense of well-being. So, you know, if you take care of your physical self, know what that feels like, take care of your mental health and know when to seek care, and then maintain a strong community around you. I mean, I think those are the three pillars of making sure that not only you will feel good on a day-to-day basis, but you'll age well.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Sharon, if someone wanted to learn more about you or more about your book, Grown Woman Talk, where would you like for me to send them?
You know what? You can go to my website, drsharonmalone.com. There is information on there about my book. There is also information about where you can get my book. And you can get, my book will be available wherever you get books sold. There's also information on there for anyone who wants any background about me, what my, you know, what my personal journey has been, how I got to this space. You know, I did a career pivot. You know, I practiced for over 30 years. And, you know, that first year of COVID, I just quit my job, you know, one of those great, great COVID resignations, but, and didn't know where I would end up. But this is something I would say to people. I, you know, I stopped when I was 62 years old, and I've gone on and created another life for myself that I didn't even know I was going to lead. And I also, the other place you can find out a little bit more about me is that I'm the chief medical advisor for Alloy Women's Health. I do a lot of education in the menopause and perimenopause space. And so we are a telehealth company. And I think that this is also part of the new paradigm shift that we've got to have in medicine. The old go take a day off from work kind of thing. There are a lot of conditions, not just menopause and perimenopause, that are amenable to telehealth environments. So if you need to find me, that's where
there
I
you
am.
Go. Okay. Well, you can go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/637, and I'll be sure to have links there. Dr. Sharon, thank you for being a part of 40 Plus Fitness.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome back, Raz.
Hey, Alan. You know, this book is really fascinating. There's a couple of really good points that Dr. Sharon brought up, but the first one being we need to be our own best primary caregiver. And to be honest, Alan, it's frustrating as heck that we've got to kind of look out for ourselves to the extent that we do. But the fact is that the doctor's office is overrun and doctors just don't know us on the personal level that they used to, like she was sharing in her youth. They just don't know us that well anymore.
Yeah. You know, we used to have one doctor, and that one doctor looked after the whole family. Mm-hmm. So they had the history. And then, you know, sometimes it was their kid that took over the practice. So they literally had the family, you know, they had the whole family in there over the course of generations. Mm-hmm. And that institutional knowledge of knowing your family, knowing you that well, gave them a huge advantage to caring for you. But with what we have now with the PPOs and everything else that's going on, you're picking a guy from a JCPenney catalog.
Right.
And, you know, okay, in my network, close enough to work and home that I can go in my day and not miss too much. And then, of course, are they available? Are they taking new patients? And you match those 3 points and you run with it. Mm-hmm. But no, you take some time, interview them, find out what their practice is about, find out who they are. Ask around, people that, you know, if you're in an office and people are in a network, ask people. It's like, who is yours? And, you know, have you worked with this person? Because I can tell you, I lived in a small town and the women did not want to go to the local gynecologist. Mm-hmm. They would literally drive an hour and a half to Little Rock. And fortunately for them, there were a couple of doctors up in Little Rock that joined our network because they just noticed what was happening. All these people from our little town were driving up to Little Rock. So they joined that network for those clients, patients. But you have to do that, and you have to go into your appointments prepared.
Yeah.
You know, what were the things that were discussed last time? Because they might not have a chance to look at it. What are some of the health concerns that you already have? What medications are you already on? Have that stuff handy so you can literally just walk in and say, here's all the medications I'm on. If you want me to take one more, well, you know, we've got to reevaluate this list. And sometimes you're even going to different doctors and getting different medications. And you hope that your pharmacist is aware, but it's the same thing. They're just filling scripts. And as long as it's in the system and it says it's due to be refilled, they'll probably refill it.
Yeah.
And I worked in that environment, and yeah, they just go on the thing and say, okay, what's due to be refilled, and they refill it. And you know, if you're not paying attention, you could be taking the wrong drugs for a long time without knowing that you should or shouldn't be taking those.
That's so true. I recently had a really odd situation, which again, this is on me, but I have a hypothyroid. I'm taking a thyroid medicine, and I came back from vacation with a cold. And so, like I always do, I reached for a decongestant. I didn't read the back of the package because I've taken this decongestant before, but then I just wasn't feeling great. And I realized that was a contraindicative drug. I should not have been taking this with a thyroid medicine that kind of wrecked my thyroid over the holidays. And I had been to urgent care. The urgent care doctor had seen all the medicines on my list and knew I was on a thyroid and was trying to treat me for this cold, but he didn't think about it either. And I'm not blaming him at all. Again, this is on me. I should have known better. I should have read the instructions. But
I remember when I was in college, in junior college anyway, I worked at a library. And in the library, we had this book called Merrick's Manual. And so people were all, it was so weird. I was Google as far as anyone was concerned. They'd pick up the phone other than drive down to the library to look it up themselves. They'd pick up the phone and ask me a question. And so I'm running around going to get a book, like reading a book and saying, this is what it says, you know?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It was crazy. And I don't know why they wanted us to do that, but they did. They said, if someone calls in and has a question and they tell you what they need and you know how to find it and answer their question. And so fine, you know, I'm sitting on a Saturday, they're asking, I go pull up the Merrick's manual back then. And this is an 85. The Merrick's manual was about 2 inches thick.
Oh gosh.
Okay. I can't even imagine. It can't be one volume anymore. If they do a book form of it, it's gotta be multiple. There's no way for a doctor to know that. You would pretty much have to put it into an AI to say, okay, here's 10 medications. Are they all okay together? Or what should we be looking for? You know, are you going to grow a third eye? You know, what's going to happen? And so, yeah, it's to that point that you need to be the grown person in your life and making the right decisions. And sometimes, and I'm not going to say go to Google and do your research, but it's easy enough for you to sit down and pull up the guidelines for a medication. And then it has, you know, what the side effects could be. It has what, you know, the counterindications of other medications you shouldn't be taking. Scratch that stuff down, go to the next one, and then just see, okay, yeah, I am taking that medication. I should not be taking these two medications at the same time.
For sure. Yep. And that especially gets complicated. Like you said, if you're seeing a number of different doctors for a number of different things, everybody's got their own opinion. Everybody's got their own medications they want to prescribe, and they're not necessarily speaking to each other. And in some cases, the different doctors that you might see, they may not be allowed to see what you've had done in your charts. I mean, you've got to give them permission to see what other doctors have done, you know, blood test wise or other analysis. So, you know, it's really, really hard, but you do have to have your own little genetic kind of history of surgeries and everything you've ever had done and have that to share with your doctor almost at every meeting.
Yeah. Well, they do have that form. You show up and they want you to tell you about every surgery, and I'm like, every surgery? And, and you're like, okay. And so, you know, but you know, it kind of is that. I mean, I tell them, it's like, yeah, I cut my thumb open and got stitches when I was 12. This is the point where I'm like, okay, this is not relevant, but they're not reading all that anyway. You know, they're walking from room to room to room. There's four or five of us sitting in different little cold ass rooms, and they're walking around and you're looking at your phone, and then they pop in, they're looking at an iPad, and they say, oh, what's the problem today? I'm like, that should be on that little piece of equipment you got right there. Because I told the girl at the front, but I'm going to tell you again too. but you go in prepared. Just go in prepared. The doctor is there to help you, but the doctor is not the CEO. You are.
Right. Right. And the other thing Dr. Sharon mentioned was having a medical family tree. And I really love that concept. It, you know, I know what my medical history is. I know about my grandparents. I was just chatting with my husband, Mike, about what his grandparents, they kind of died at much younger ages than my grandparents. And so all of that information, as morbid as it really is helpful for my kids. So now my kids have a medical family history to look at. And it's just helpful to know. I mean, even right now, as I've shared with you and our listeners, my husband had kidney cancer. Well, that's not necessarily a normal genetic type of cancer. My kids know to be aware of it should something ever happen later in life for them. So, you know, all of that information is as sad as it is to have, is important to have.
Yeah. Well, I knew my father had been born with a cleft lip. So when my daughter was about to be born, I let the doctor know that, you know, that my father had a cleft lip, and that is somewhat genetic. So I just wasn't sure if that was something that was going to affect her. But at least I knew. And so that's the whole point, taking the time to go through and have these discussions. You know, she was talking about just, you know, you do a family reunion where everybody's together for the holidays. It can be kind of a morbid thing, but, you know, just tell me how Aunt Betsy died. I want to know more, you know, what was she going through? It's like, you know, because there's all kinds of things that could be different for you or could be the same, but it's worth knowing so that you know. Yes. And then you can get some genetic testing. It's like, okay, three women in your past, you know, line have had breast cancer, it's like, mm-hmm. I might want to get that DNA test just to see mm-hmm. if I'm following along with the same code. Mm-hmm. I should probably know that, and then I can make better health decisions going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, super helpful. Yeah. Really interesting book. Great conversation.
Thank you. All right. So I guess I'll talk to you next week.
You betcha. Take care.
You too.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
If you enjoyed today's show, take a moment to subscribe so you won't miss the next one. And if you would, please leave us a rating and review on your podcast player of choice. Next time on the 40 Plus Fitness podcast, we meet Risa Grew and discuss her book, Food Frame. Diet is a four-letter word. Until then, have a happy and healthy week.